Welcome to the Endless Knot Podcast,
where the more we know,
the more we want to find out,
tracing serendipitous connections through our lives
and across disciplines.
Hi, I'm Avon.
And I'm Mark.
Today, we're going to be talking about beef. But before I explain that, we've got a couple of items of follow-up to get to, and a few other announcements or things to talk about. So the very first thing I wanted to mention was another podcast recommendation for you. I keep finding more of them. I didn't mention this last time, but there's a podcast called The Classy Little Podcast, which is two people, two friends, who drink wine, eat cheese, and talk about a range of different interesting things. Each episode is about a different topic. Circuses, or social media, or ice cream, and things like that. And they're fun and interesting, and they do good research, but they also make it entertaining. And they really like wine and cheese and talk about what they're eating and drinking. So I feel a great kinship with them. And once I found them, I realized that this is definitely a podcast I'd like.
That's what we need. More cheese.
Yeah. I don't think I need more cheese in my life. I mean, I want more cheese in my life, but I don't think I need it.
Or maybe for this episode, we should be eating some beef.
Well, we'll get back to that. Anyway, I just wanted to recommend them, and if you enjoy our podcast, you may very well enjoy theirs. So that's The Classy Little Podcast. The second thing I wanted to mention is a bit of follow-up. In keeping with our ongoing discussion about color, which we will come back to, don't worry, fairly soon.
We see this every episode.
The writer Carolyn Lawrence, who writes a series of murder mysteries or mysteries set in Pompeii with children as their protagonists, they're really good. She's very active on Twitter and happened to tweet a little while ago her Pinterest page of a Roman color thesaurus. I'll put up a link. What it is she's essentially collected images that are examples of things that a Roman would recognize as terms you would describe as a color. So cherries for cherry red, or sandalwood, what color is sandalwood, or the kinds of dyes they actually had. So wools dyed with onion skins and with saffron and with various actual things they used to dye. So that, I guess, for her writing, she can describe things in terms that would be meaningful to a Roman rather than in terms that wouldn't mean anything to them. So, for instance, if we describe something as neon pink or electric blue, that wouldn't mean anything. That would obviously be inappropriate to a story about Roman times. But if they describe something as saffron yellow, that might not be clear to us, but she wants clearly to have a sort of range in her head. Anyway, it's a really interesting page, and it gives you a good idea of what some of these colors that we've been mentioning might have looked like. So I'm going to put a link to that in the show notes, and I think it might be of interest to people. Okay, those are my two little pieces of follow-up I wanted to do. The next thing I want to do is mention something sort of technical, which is to say thank you to our Patreon supporters for enabling us to buy some new mics and upgrade our recording equipment. I don't know if it sounds any different. I hope it sounds good, maybe even better. But most importantly, what this is going to do is save me a bunch of time for reasons that I won't necessarily get into. I was having to do more editing than I should have had to make our recording sound good. And this should hopefully make it a lot easier. And we've been able to do that in part because people have been generous in supporting us. So thank you very much for that.
Yeah, thank you. I've got all these little knobs here, which I'm not allowed to play with, but
on a mixer.
Yes.
Knobs on a mixer.
That's of course what I meant. But yes, it's definitely an upgrade in terms of our technical capability, so this should make the job a lot easier and hopefully the result a lot better, though we're still learning the equipment and the right settings and so forth, so bear with us if we have to...
If things don't immediately improve as much as they could.
Yes, exactly. And this just made me, since we do talk about a lot of other podcasts and other podcasters, it made me want to sort of raise the question of, if you are a podcaster, what sort of equipment do you use? Up till now, we've been recording with USB mics, and we're now switching to sort of more old school technology of analog microphones plugged into a mixing board and then connecting that to the computer. I'd be interested just to know what other people's sort of experience with the technology is and what works best, what are the potential problems and so forth.
Mm-hmm. We've been relying, to be frank, on Reddit Reddit podcasting subreddits for some of our advice, and that's not a bad place to look. I mean, there's a lot of very passionate podcasters there, but it runs the gamut there of people doing all sorts of different kinds of podcasts, solo or creative ones or always interview. And so it isn't always easy to map their experience onto what will work for us. So
yeah, we have the added difficulty of needing to use two microphones, which I think complicates things quite a bit.
So anyway, it would be interesting to hear any thoughts anyone has on that. And certainly if you hear anything, you know, we're happy to hear feedback that includes things like there's something in the audio that is annoying to you. Let us know.
Yeah, and we can try and figure out how to fix that.
Or ignore you.
Yes.
Either way. But it would be good to know, because I'd like to know if it's something that we can and want to change. And it's sometimes hard to hear those things in your own work. Okay, that out of the way. One more thing. We've recently put up some new stuff in our merchandise store. Now, I don't know if we've mentioned that very much, but we have put a few things up on a Cafe Press store of Endless Knot merchandise, mostly centered around the videos, using some of the art that we've put together for the videos and putting it into posters and stickers and mugs. And we've also put the logo on some t-shirts and stickers and things like that. But we've also put the podcast logo on a few things. Don't know if it's of interest to anyone, but just wanted to tell you that we had a couple of things there, but we finally put a number of other items up. And if you wanted to check that out, I'll put a link in the show notes. It's also on our website under store. And you could take a look around. We've also put a form up on our website asking you to suggest anything, any images that you've seen on some of the videos that you think would make good merchandise or that you'd like to see. Let us know. We can do that pretty easily. There's a lot of things we potentially could put up, but we don't know how much interest there is. So any feedback would be helpful. All right. Now, all of that done with, let's move on to the substance of this podcast. Today, as I said, we're going to talk about beef. So in keeping with that, and for reasons that will become clear soon, we're drinking drinks, cocktails.
As usual.
Containing Beefeater gin.
Indeed. Not our normal brand of gin, or one of our normal brands of gin.
Not that I have anything against it, but we tend to go with Bombay Sapphire as our bar drink and a number of craft gins these days as well. But yeah, Beefeater gin for the beef and the Beefeater on it.
Indeed.
A piece of trivia that I just found out by looking at the Beefeater website. The founder of the distillery that created Beefeater gin, James Burroughs, while born in Devon, actually moved to and practiced as a pharmacist in Toronto in the 19th century before moving back to England and starting at the distillery.
So a nice Canadian connection for us.
We, as all Canadians know, will claim anyone who has stood on Canadian soil for more than 5 minutes as a Canadian in some form if it comes to finding people who've done interesting things. Canadian content. The specific cocktail I'm drinking is a White Lady, a very classic gin cocktail with gin, Cointreau, lemon juice, and egg white.
And I've gone for, well, the classic standard gin and tonic.
So cheers. Thud. All right, so why are we talking about beef today, Mark?
Well, this is based on one of the videos from way back, I think January 2015, I think it first came out, looking at the etymology of the word beef. And as you'll soon discover when we listen to the voiceover, the idea for this came from, well, teaching and, you know, one of the standard examples that's always given when looking at English vocabulary and how there's French vocabulary in English as a result of the Norman conquest.
Right.
So that was the initial inspiration. But when I discovered the sort of deeper etymology of the word, it was so surprisingly interesting to me that I thought I could spin a whole story out of it. And as it turned out, it had an interesting sort of sub-theme, which we'll soon hear about.
So why don't we listen to the voiceover and then we can talk about it. And then I think we've both prepared a few things to discuss that come out of the video. So we can talk about that afterwards. Partly this is to keep on the food theme that we seem to have had going for the last few episodes and that is of perennial interest to us and seems to be of interest to people listening too.
One of the first things you'll hear when people talk about the history of the English language is the large-scale import of French vocabulary into English when the French-speaking Normans under William the Conqueror invaded Anglo-Saxon England in 1066. This sometimes led to modern English having pairs of words, one from each source, like cow and beef, sheep and mutton, swine and pork, In each case, two words for the same animal, one from Anglo-Saxon, one from Norman French. You see, only a relatively small number of Normans came over with William, maybe 5,000 at the time of the invasion, with another 20,000 over the next little while, compared to the 1.5 million total population of England at the time. But William put his fellow Normans in all the positions of power and influence. They were the major landowners, and the Anglo-Saxon populace made up the peasantry. And so, the senses of these pairs of words break down on socio-economic lines. The Anglo-Saxon-derived cow came to refer only to the animal cared for by the Anglo-Saxon peasant, and the French-derived beef came to refer only to the meat consumed by the rich Norman landowners. Same goes for sheep and mutton, and swine and pork. Turns out they've been using French to fancy up menus for a very long time. The French bœuf, which turned into beef, comes from Latin bos bovis, which much later on came into English again as the adjective bovine. That Latin bov root is also part of the brand name Bovril. Bovril is a meat extract, somewhat similar to Marmite, which can be spread on toast or mixed with hot water to make a soup-like broth. Bovril was invented in the 1870s by Scotsman John Lawson Johnson while in Canada, fulfilling an order to the French government to supply canned beef for the troops who had been undersupplied in the recently ended Franco-Prussian War. After all, we know an army marches on its stomach. Johnson had been put onto the science of food preservation when he studied at the University of Edinburgh under chemist and statesman Lyon Playfair, whose own contributions to science were somewhat less appetizing. In his political career, while Secretary of Science, Playfair advocated the use of chemical weapons against the Russians in the Crimean War, the first proposal for chemical warfare. The plan was considered, but was rejected as being unethical and against the rules of warfare, though Playfair would argue that war was inherently destructive anyway, and anything that made it more destructive without increasing suffering would in fact end up decreasing suffering, an argument that continues to be used for advances in the science of killing. The irony is, of course, inescapable that this plan was put forward by a man named Playfair. But getting back to Bovril, what about the second element of the word? For that, Johnson was inspired by an outlandish science fiction novel called Vril, The Power of the Coming Race, which features a subterranean civilization of superhumans who derive their power from a mystical liquid called Vril. The 1871 novel was written by Edward Bulwer Lytton, a politician and aristocrat who is notable for coining a lot of well-known expressions, such as the great unwashed, the almighty dollar, and the clichéd literary opening, It Was a Dark and Stormy Night. With such obvious talent, no wonder Bulwer Lytton valued literary over military endeavor, turning down an offer of a lordship of the Admiralty, as well as the throne of Greece, lest it interfere with his literary career. And no surprise that he also coined the phrase, the pen is mightier than the sword. Bulwer Lytton's novel Vril was so influential it not only inspired the name Bovril, but apparently convinced many people that Vril and the underground civilization it supported were real. This may have inspired Nazi-era occultists, at least according to science writer Willy Lee, who fled Nazi Germany to resettle in the United States and advocate the development of rocketry. This accusation was picked up on by conspiracy theorists who imagined the Nazis wanted to use this mystical Vril to win the war. But of course, the story is just a load of tripe. But getting back to the etymology of the word beef, it actually comes from a Proto-Indo-European root, which also, it turns out, gives us the word cow by way of the Germanic branch of languages. So in fact, though we started off with the commonly made observation that the words beef and cow are a record of the battles between the French and English in the Norman conquest, etymologically, they're the same word after all. As with most war and conflict, our differences often end up being surface level anyway, and everything is interconnected. So, as you can hear, the sort of surprise twist at the end is that beef and cow, though commonly held as this sort of
contrasting pair,
iconic contrasting pair, in fact come from the same Proto-Indo-European root. And it's a really surprising one, given the sound changes that happened, because they don't sound at all similar, unlike many.
Yeah, cow and beef certainly don't sound like they have anything to do with one another. And it's a good lesson in how, I suppose, it's the opposite of false friends. Things that sound similar aren't necessarily the same route. Things that sound very different can come from the same place, because there's a heck of a long time.
Yeah.
You know, between Proto-Indo-European and Norman French or Anglo-Saxon English, you have to remind yourself that that's a lot of changes for a language to go through. And while they may be predictable at every stage, sort of like some of your other discussions of connections, when you only see the beginning and the end, they don't look very similar at all. Mm-hmm.
So this is not only a story about historical linguistics, but also sociolinguistics, because it deals with the sociopolitical situation surrounding that particular period, the Norman invasion.
Mm-hmm. It's a way of looking at linguistics that both relies on and also tells you about social interactions between groups of people mm-hmm. and economic issues yep. and structures of power and mm-hmm. all those sorts of things.
And one way of thinking of this interaction between English and Norman French at the time is thinking of it as a kind of pidgin.
Right.
Which is a sort of simplified language that develops when you have two cultures coming into contact. Generally, what happens is one is a high prestige language and one is a lower prestige language due to some sort of power difference.
Imbalance, yeah.
Power imbalance. And so typically what happens in these situations is the pidgin develops with the grammar from the substrate, the lower prestige language, mm-hmm. but borrows a lot of vocabulary from the high prestige language.
Interesting.
And that's certainly the case.
What happens in English, yeah.
With English. Mm-hmm. And then eventually when a pidgin becomes a native language, a mother tongue, mm-hmm. we then call it a Creole.
Right. And then if it develops an army, we call it a language, right?
Yes. So that's probably something similar to the process that happened with English and mm-hmm. Norman French.
Moving from Anglo-Saxon to Middle English
to, Middle English. Middle English is something of a Creole that developed from those two sources, which is why we have all this French vocabulary. Mm-hmm. I should explain, by the way, just because it's one of my favorite little factoids, where the word pigeon comes from. It has nothing to do with the bird, probably, though there has been a suggestion that it has something to do with messages, short messages that a pigeon might carry, but I don't think that suggestion is very likely. More likely, it comes from a pigeon word itself, from the pigeon that developed between English and Chinese speakers during the era of empire and trade, mm-hmm. and it basically developed from the word business.
Right.
So it's a business language. It was a language that developed
to do trade.
So we mentioned Bovril, and I'd be interested to know, I mean, I used to think of Bovril simply as a soup base.
Mm-hmm. I've always,
as a drink.
As a hot drink.
Mm-hmm. But it is apparently also used in the way that you would use Marmite, spreading it on.
So you say.
Yes,
we need support for this.
We need support. So if you are the sort of person who
spreads Bovril on your toast.
Let us know.
Out yourself now. Bovril's not really a thing in North America. And I mean,
neither is Marmite for that matter.
No, though in my house Marmite was because I had a British father,
yes.
but we still didn't get Bovril. But I do remember having beef stock
right.
as a drink when we were sick or something and you needed a little bit of something with a little bit of food in it. But we used OXO cubes. It was just really the same thing, but probably even less beefy.
Right.
I think it's basically salt and MSG
right.
in a cube. but I knew of Bovril probably from children's books or something, but I always knew of it as a drink.
I've never had it on toast myself, although I am quite a fan of Marmite.
Yeah, and you used to eat meat paste as a child, so I mean,
well,
you might
true.
Do anything. Anything is possible.
So one of these days I am going to try Bovril on toast just to see. And of course, the other interesting Bovril connection there is the football culture. It's become, from what I gather, a staple of the football fans.
Talking UK football here.
UK football.
Or European football.
But particularly UK football.
But as opposed to North American football.
As opposed to North American football. A useful thing, I guess, to have a hot beverage sitting out in the stands. Mm-hmm.
North American football could probably actually use it.
Yes, that's true.
It's pretty darn cold. American football in particular, which goes on well into the winter.
Though I've read on the internet, apparently, that in Scotland, thermoses of Bovril are banned from stadiums because they're too easily used as projectiles. I don't know if this is just
an outright calumny against the yes. Scots, I'm sure.
And then, of course, there's beefeaters, like our gin.
Hence the beefeater gin, indeed. Mm-hmm.
The idea being that if you were a beefeater, you were well-fed. So these are the sort of elite guard. Mm-hmm. Beefeaters are the guards at the Tower of London, I guess.
Presumably, at one point, not just ceremonial guards, but actually guards of the prison. I guess the Tower of London was a prison.
So those are well-fed if they're being fed beef. Not everyone gets to have beef.
Well, as we know, only the upper class, mm-hmm. because the lower class just raise them.
And so that term started out as a kind of nickname for those guards. And it's an interesting parallel with an Anglo-Saxon word, hlaf-ata, since we've spoken about loaf just a couple of episodes ago. Hlaf-ata means loaf eater, and it's a word that means dependent or underling or something like that. Mm. And just because it's another one of my favorite little sideline etymologies, from that same root, the beef root in Greek, it's bous, right?
Yep.
From that, we get bustiron. I think I'm pronouncing that correctly, which means literally cow cheese. It's the word for butter.
Oh, right. Yes, it's your butter link.
The butter word. Yeah. So if you want a little bit of butter for your beef sandwich, I don't know if you'd put butter on the bread if you were making a beef sandwich. That seems odd.
I have no opinion on that. I'd put mayonnaise on, but there you go.
And since I'm on the topic of butter, butterfly is one of my...
Yeah, you're getting to hit all of your pet little cocktail party factoids, aren't you?
Why is it called a butterfly? What does it have to do with butter? Well, there's a number of theories, one of which is that the butterfly steals the butter. And, you know, there's the suggestion that there may be some kind of magically transformed witches or something stealing your butter.
A folktale idea.
It's a folktale idea, folktale suggestion. And this is supported by the German Milchdieb, which means
milk thief.
Yeah. The other suggestion, of course, is that the, not to put too fine a point on it, the excrement of the butterfly somehow resembles butter.
Yeah, that one doesn't make any sense to me, among other things, because butterflies, most of them, don't excrete.
Well, yes.
A whole bunch of, not most of them, a whole bunch of butterflies don't anyway. It's not all butterflies even eat. So it's all very complicated.
But perhaps our Dutch listeners out there can help to support this possible interpretation, because the, as I gather, the Dutch word for butterfly literally means butter shit.
Okay.
So maybe there's something to it.
The other explanation you've given is that it is a playful version of Flutterby, isn't it? Or something like that? Or
that's a folk etymology, I think.
See, it makes more sense to me than butter shit.
I'm actually, down with the butter shit idea.
Immortal phrases to utter. I'm down with the butter shit.
Well, the Dutch evidence seems too good. So
yeah, it's all down to the Dutch. Okay.
So one last little nugget, is this guy Playfair. He's one of my favorites, and he keeps coming up. He comes up in a number of videos.
He's one of your favorites because he's interesting, not because he's a nice guy, right? Because he's kind of a horrible
person. He's kind
of
a jerk, yeah. But you may have heard of the Playfair cipher.
Listener, I have heard of the Playfair cipher. You may not have heard of the Playfair cipher. Trust me, I have heard of the Playfair cipher.
Ah, but if you've seen the sequel of the...
The sequel to National Treasure?
National Treasure. Mm-hmm. Not the first one, but the second one. It mentions the Playfair cipher.
We are very highbrow around
this
here.
This is really scraping the bottom of the barrel here, but...
Timely and high-class pop culture references only on this podcast.
But if you're into ciphers, you would know this one, because this is a pretty famous one.
Actually, it's not actually obscure.
No.
It's just you've mentioned a lot recently.
Yes. Well, the Playfair cipher is not invented by Playfair, but is named after him by his friend Charles Wheatstone, who is the inventor of the concertina and a number of other wacky inventions, including the method. Well, this is not so wacky. It's quite important, but he invented the method that was eventually used to measure the speed of light, which is
fairly
significant. Mm-hmm. And a number of other interesting things like the stereoscope and a speech synthesis machine and so forth. Anyways, this inventor, Wheatstone, invented the Playfair cipher and named it after his friend, Mr. Playfair. But my last sort of particularly amusing story about Playfair is that he was given the job of investigating the quality of the sewers, the sort of privies were backing up. And so he was given the job
in London
mm-hmm. of figuring this out. Not the most glamorous
He came back and told them, it's all the butter. It's all the butter.
If only. Well, no, he was doing this with his friend, Henry de la Beche. His job was, he took the role of test vomiter. I don't know exactly what this role involved. But I don't think I really want to investigate it any further than that. But the two of them, were test vomiting.
I'm going to believe that it's like the vomitorium in the Roman world, which it doesn't actually have anything to do with vomit. Vomiting. The vomitorium in Rome was the exits of the Colosseum.
Right.
Which allowed people to leave.
Leave, yes.
There was no vomitorium, the room to which they went to throw up so that they could eat more at orgies. That's not a thing. So I'm going to believe that the test vomiters were just people who threw things down the sewers. On no evidence whatsoever, but because it will make it easier for me to continue to drink my cocktail.
Well, if you know any more about this story, I'd love to hear it.
All right. Well, if that's your pieces of follow-up from the video for now.
For now.
I have a couple of things. The first one is in reference to something very specific in the video.
Hmm.
You made the little joke that the English have been fancying up their menus by using French words for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And it made me think of something we just read. So a couple of days ago, we bought a Greek cookbook.
Right.
There's a Greek festival that's held at a church two doors down from here, at a lovely Greek Orthodox church. And they have a Greek festival every year, and they have lovely food. And we went over, and they had a cookbook this time, and we picked it up. And it is quite comprehensive, it seems, though possibly slightly amateurly put together, but that's okay. It has a little preface, though, in which the author essentially defends Greek food against Turkish appropriation. And argues that although many Greek dishes have Turkish names, that doesn't mean they're Turkish dishes. They're really Greek dishes. And makes the parallel specifically to English and French cooking, and says Greek cooks were always known as the best cooks from the time of Constantinople onward, and that is why the Turks always had Greek cooks, and so they named it Turkish things, but they had Greek cooks. Like the French cooks in England, and they had where the English had French cooks because they were the best cooks. It's not a good example because it's a very confused about which direction the change goes. But he goes on to say, therefore, if we talk about these foods with English terms, shall we then call it English cookery when it's clearly French cookery? No. In the same way, we shouldn't call it Turkish cookery when it's clearly Greek cookery. Now, that doesn't really make sense because, in fact, the English kept the French words for things and called it French cookery.
Yeah.
So it doesn't make sense. But what I really wanted to point to there is pointing out the really meaningful political ramifications of language.
Yes.
And in this case, of language of food.
Mm-hmm.
However poorly argued the preface there is, it's clearly important to the author of this cookbook, really important, whether these dishes are called by Turkish names or Greek names, who owns them, what ethnicity is associated with them. That's obviously because the Greeks and the Turks have a very long history that is very complicated and antagonistic and has to do with the questions of empire and imperialism and independence and nationalism, much like the English and French with their long and complicated history of empire and nationalism and all of the rest of it. This book is very recent. It's obviously still a fresh and important issue for this author in a way that is not probably so important to most English speakers in the UK now about French language. It's more of a dead issue. But these things matter. And food is one of the places that it matters because everybody eats.
Yeah,
and
they're both food and language are very personal things, right?
And everyone feels a certain ownership of it, and they are used. Food and language are both massively important as identifiers of group and as identifiers of what tribe you belong to in a larger sense, whether it's nation or religion or whatever. Mm-hmm. So they matter.
Yeah.
And when they intersect,
then it's just really, doubly really important.
So I just wanted to bring that up because it seemed like a really interesting parallel. The other stuff I wanted to talk about, and I mentioned this to you, Mark, so you know a little bit that I wanted to talk about it, was talking about these pairings of agricultural terms. One of the things related, but not exactly the same, is the levels of different kinds of words for these agricultural animals. So you were talking about making this contrast, the socioeconomic contrast between the animal on the hoof and the animal on the plate.
Yeah.
But there's also this whole set of language related to the agricultural side of it, of the different kinds of animals for our farm animals, the different ages and sexes and stages of the animals that have to do with their importance as usually meat animals or dairy animals or, whatever it is they produce for us.
Mm-hmm.
And the more important and sort of specialized the animals, the more terms there are for them in a culture in general. So one of the things that's interesting now in our very urbanized world is how little we know about those distinctions.
Yeah.
Kids learn still all these farmyard animals, even if many of them never see a farmyard animal, but they learn cow, chicken, goat, and sheep.
Mm-hmm.
They don't learn heifer, bullock, steer.
No, that's true. Yeah,
they don't learn those terms.
Words.
They don't learn ewe and ram and lamb, and they don't learn cockerel and pullet and rooster. They might learn rooster and hen. There's a bunch of different terms in English, and those are left over from, and I'm sure they're still used in many communities. It's not that they're completely some of them are more archaic than others, but I'm sure they are still actively used in communities of people who deal with the animals, mm-hmm. you know, in farming communities.
But you don't see them in the kids' books.
You don't see them in kids' books. And where this comes up is, for me, on a sort of real life level, is in translating Latin.
Right.
And Greek too, but I'm going to stick to Latin today because my knowledge of Greek agricultural terms is worse. So we're going to stick to Latin.
Okay.
But the Latin that we have, you know, it comes from a time when even if the people writing the Latin texts that we have were not themselves farmers in a hands-on kind of way, mm-hmm. they were landowners usually. So they were kind of farmers by extension. And anyway, it was just as a community, way more in contact with agricultural concerns. And so the various words for all sorts of types, very specific types of animals, turn up in Latin texts all the time.
Right.
And not just in prose, you know, about farms. A lot of poetry, which is my particular interest, has a lot of these terms in it. And they get translated, but I often find that for students, they're translated into what might as well be still Latin.
A foreign word.
Because
yeah.
if you translate it as heifer and bullock and steer, they don't even know that that's necessarily cow. And I'm not laughing at my students for this because, trust me, I had to go look up a bunch of these terms multiple times. That, you know, I don't know them either, really. I know some of them now because I've seen them so often. But, you know, this is a whole register, in a, basically, that we don't, the most of my students have no reason to know. So I thought it might be interesting to talk about some of these words in Latin because they do turn up. And they have, I think there's some interesting... Well, you tell me if there's some interesting etymological stuff about them.
Yeah, I'll mention the English derivatives of them
and
or
how they kind
how
of
they connect.
Yeah. So to start with, sort of general term for cattle, there's the word pecus, which is
right.
a collective term, collective singular, for and a group of animals, a group of farm animals. It can mean sheep or cattle,
mm-hmm.
but it very often means cattle. And of course, pecus is interesting.
Because it's got this monetary connection to it.
Mm-hmm. Because pecus means cattle, and therefore by extension, it means property.
Yeah.
And then there's a whole set of words that have to do with ownership of property and therefore wealth.
Yeah. So I guess the most common English derivative of that is pecuniary.
Yeah.
I don't know if you can think of another more common one than that.
Impecunious.
Impecunious.
I don't think that's more
that's
common.
Not necessarily more common, but yeah.
It's another word. So, you know, you can see it now. Those are high style words. There's a whole set of important Latin concepts to do with the peculium, which is
right.
property owned but not really owned by a slave or a son. But anyway, we won't get into all of that. But yeah, so it gets this connotation of wealth in general.
Right.
Another word for a herd of cattle is an armentum.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know exactly where that comes from. Armentum.
Armentum.
No, it doesn't seem
sure.
it doesn't seem connected to anything else that I know of. Okay, so I'll just mention that. Now, the word that you've already mentioned that is the word that gives us boeuf and beef is bos, right?
Bos, bovis,
right?
Yes.
So that means cattle. It means bull or cow. So it's that's the general bovine animal word.
Yep.
Okay. Then of course we have taurus or taurus.
Right.
Which means bull.
Bull.
It's Greek. So that's one's taken over pretty much wholesale from Greek and is the term for, you know, an uncastrated adult male cow. I know that we can't. See, to me, the word cow is non-gender specific, which is, of course, untrue.
Yes.
But we don't have a non-gender specific
no.
word for cow. We have cattle, but
suppose.
That's a collective
group
noun,
term,
right?
Yeah.
So it's hard to say a male cattle. Mm-hmm. That doesn't make any sense. So anyway, a bull. And of course, it gives us the astrological sign, which is how most people know it now, too.
Taurus, yeah. And I guess also part of Minotaur, so.
Yes, that's how.
Another way people would know
the word, yeah. Interestingly, Torah, so Taurus, but with an A on the end,
yeah.
means a barren cow.
Oh.
That must have been a fairly technical
that's
term.
Interesting.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, this is one of those, a number of these words turn up in like Pliny, and Vero, and maybe Cato the Elder talking about farming, right? So,
a barren cow is somehow masculine-ish.
I guess. Is a female bull? I mean, I don't know. I don't know what's going on there, but it's interesting. So the normal word for a cow, female, is a vaca. Or waka, if I'm going to be properly Latinate. But if I say waka, then it's waka. But
from which we get vaccinate.
Right.
Which I mentioned in another video.
Yes. And vache, of course.
In French, yes, yeah. Of course.
So that's the word that gives us our standard French word for cow and a number of other Romance language words for cow. Yeah.
Vaccinate, by the way, because the original vaccination was for, well, for smallpox, but it was developed from cowpox, a similar
form of the disease that they used vaccinate people.
Yeah, to vaccinate people. So that's how that comes in.
Mm-hmm. And then a vacula, which is just the diminutive of vaca, is a young cow or a heifer. So heifer means young female cow.
Yeah.
Usually not having born a calf yet.
Right.
That's what a heifer usually means. So vacula, that's simple. That's just a... And then interestingly, bucula also means a young cow or a heifer. So I assume, I didn't look up the actual Latin etymologies of these things, but I assume the vaca and buca
come from the same root.
We don't have, I can't find evidence for buca by itself, but bucula is a young cow and buculus is a steer, which is a young male cow. So I presume those are the same word.
Now, the English equivalent of the sort of young, the yearling, is, of course, veal, or we use that to refer to the meat.
To the meat, yes.
And that does come from a Latin root. It's related to vellum, which is the
skin,
the skin of the leather, animal that's used to make a writing material. And it's related to vetus.
Which is age or
age. Yeah.
Old
so
age.
The idea being that the root means a year. So it's a yearling specifically.
Okay. Right. That's interesting. Yeah. I don't have that as a list. Do you have anything about heifer?
No, I'm not sure where heifer comes from, but I can probably let you know very quickly.
All right. Well, Mark looks that up. I will tell you a couple of other Latin words. Juvenca is a young cow or a heifer as well. Now that's really obvious because juvenis is young. So that just means a young female thing. And a unix is also a young cow or a heifer. So that is four separate terms to mean heifer, which shows the importance of that particular stage of a cow's life.
Wow, okay, that's interesting. It comes from an old English word.
Heifer does.
Yeah, the first element being high, heach, in the sense of great in size. The second element might be from fer, which means bull. So a high bull.
A high bull or a big bull
means
a young cow? English people are weird.
The second element might also be from faron, to go.
That doesn't make any more sense.
So high stepper.
All those high stepping young cows. Okay, I don't, that doesn't illuminate anything for me.
But there's an alternate suggestion that it could be, could have developed from hagfora. So hag meaning enclosure. Like haw and hedge.
Okay.
And the fora is a suffix meaning dweller or occupant. So the
hedge dweller.
Hedge dweller or enclosure dweller.
Yeah, that's not making any sense either.
Yeah.
Okay, moving on. One that I just thought I'd mention because it seems so out of place with all of these is horda, H-O-R-D-A.
Huh.
Or forda. They are given as interchangeable forms, horda and forda.
These are words I do not know.
A cow that is pregnant.
Ooh, well, no wonder I haven't come across it.
No, not a word that clearly gives us anything in English that I know of, or in French or anything else. And I haven't seen those in Latin. I only found that by looking things up in the dictionary. Most of these other ones, I haven't seen all of them, but most of these I have seen before.
Right.
But that one was new to me. Anyway, I just thought it was interesting that there was that tech. I can see why there would be a term for a pregnant cow. That would be really important, actually, because you need to get a cow pregnant to get milk and all sorts of things. But vitulus or vitula is a calf.
Oh, well, that must be from the same
probably,
root as veal, then.
So that probably gives it, is connected to the veal word. Bubula is beef, the meat.
Oh, so they do have a
they
separate
do have
word,
a word
for meat.
For meat.
Okay.
Bubula. But bubula. It's clearly just from the bos.
Right.
But reduplicated, right? So, bubula. Reduplicated and diminutive.
Hmm.
Bubula. But I just like that because it's funny. Okay, so that's cows.
What are we going to move on to next?
Sheep.
Sheep, okay.
So sheep, we've got our basic word, ovis.
Right.
O-V-I-S. That means sheep. And it can mean a ewe, that is a female sheep, if it's in opposition to the word for ram.
Right.
But it is generally a gender-neutral word. The word for ram is Aries, Aries, as people would know it from the astrology, right? A-R-I-E-S, Aries. So we've got a word for ewe and word for a ram, though not, interestingly, there's not really a strong word for a female sheep, because it's just the standard word for sheep. And Agnus or Agna is a lamb.
Right.
That one, very familiar to many people, I think, from Christian
context.
Christian context, the Lamb of God, Agnus Dei. Now, this one I like. ambidens, a sheep with both top and bottom teeth.
From ambi
and dens.
Dens,
now,
yes,
the derivation of the word is not surprising. Why you would need a word for a sheep with both top and bottom teeth is the unclear bit. It's listed in a couple of places. Basically, it's in a late 8th century digest of Festus, who's this obscure author. So it must be a very technical term. I think it probably has to do with age, because animals' teeth come in at particular ages, right, and then they also lose teeth over time.
Okay.
So it probably has to do with age. But maybe a farmer can tell me more about it if you're a sheep farmer and you know why that would be a particular thing you'd want to distinguish. I just think it's funny. Oh, also in the weirdly specific words for sheep, apica, A-P-I-C-A, a sheep with no wool on its belly.
On its belly?
On its belly. Not no wool.
Just no wool on its belly.
No wool on its belly. Again, I don't know enough about sheep to know why that's a specific condition you would need a word for. Other words, there's probata, which is the Greek word for sheep, which is used, comes from a Greek collective noun for sheep, and it turns up as a Latin word. Agnina and ovellinus are the words for lamb meat and mutton.
Right, so those
again,
are derived from...
So you can see how it's similar to bubula.
Right.
So agnina from agnus for lamb, and then ovellinus from ovis for mutton.
Right.
Mutton meaning adult sheep meat. And this one I just had to include because I like it so much. Do you know what sound a sheep makes in Latin? It goes... B. Though the word for bleating is ballo, and a sheep is sometimes called balans. So bleating, right, a bleating thing. So ballo and balans suggest the ba that we think of sheep as going.
Right.
Some of these terms only came from the Lewis and Short Dictionary, by the way.
Okay.
Interestingly. So there's a number of these that seem to be late or non-classical. But that may be that they're late and non-classical in evidence. It doesn't mean that they're necessarily late terms. It just may mean that we don't have a classical source for them.
Okay.
You know, like we don't have a classical source for the word bee as the sound that sheep make.
Right.
That may have more to do with the sorts of sources we have medieval and from classical,
right, sure,
than whether or not it changed over time. And then the other one is grex. Gregus is the word for flock.
Right.
Right. So like armentum or hecus is for cattle, grex.
From which we get congregate.
Yep.
And congregation.
Congregation and egregious.
And egregious,
standing
out of the flock.
Unusual, Okay, so that's sheep.
Well, and the word sheep itself, this is a bit of a mystery word. It's a Germanic only. Hmm. We don't have an ultimate...
No cognates.
But one speculation is that it might be related to the word shape. So meaning basically just creature, formed thing, a creature. So that's probably the most likely.
Okay.
But what I thought was interesting is mutton, which we have as the word for...
Older meat.
For the meat. Yeah. Comes obviously through French,
mouton,
through Latin, but ultimately probably from a Celtic source.
But what is the Latin word it comes from? It must be a non-classical.
It's probably
a vulgar
late,
Latin, because that wasn't in my list, right?
Mm. Yeah. And it probably comes in through a Celtic source.
Yeah. Okay, interesting. There's a couple of words for goats. I don't need to dwell on them, but there's caper.
Right.
So we know that from Capricorn.
Capricorn.
Right? Mm-hmm. Many of these words are probably most familiar to people from the astrology tables. So a caper is a billy goat. A capella is a she-goat or a nanny goat. And then moving away from that, a haidus is a young goat or a kid. I don't know if that's the same word in a different form, haidus for caper, but I don't think so.
Haidus, I believe, is related to the word goat.
Okay, I can see that. I can see that because of the education you've given me in seeing unrelated things as looking like they're related, but yeah.
Yeah, it seems to go back to Proto-Indo-European root gaido, so producing goat and haidus. Yeah.
Okay, but that's all we have in Latin. I don't think goats were certainly raised in Rome for sure, but they were less important to the Romans than they were to the Greeks for reasons of geography. Goats were really important. Goats and sheep, really important to the Greeks. They couldn't raise cattle nearly as easily. The Romans had a better agricultural setting and didn't need goats the same way. So for them, it's sheep and cattle.
Goats can survive anywhere.
Yeah, goats goats can and do survive everywhere. Whereas in Rome, they had goats, but they had more sheep and cattle. So
that's why
just
I keep saying we should get a goat.
I know. We'll have to see how it does against the bears.
Well, yeah.
I'm laying even odds on that. I'm not saying that goats couldn't
fight off bears,
but I'm just saying it's not a given. So, okay, two more sets. So swine in general,
mm-hmm.
We have porcus for a male pig.
Yeah.
And in the plural, it just means pigs, gender neutral. Porca is a sow. Porcellus or porculus or porculus. Any of the various ways of making a diminutive is a piglet, of course. Sus is a pig or sow. Yep. A lot of the words that mean like a pig come from that root. So it's clearly an important pig word.
That's where the suey.
Yeah, suey.
The call.
As a call for pigs.
For a pig. Yeah, it comes from.
Said to come from, yeah. Then there's two other unrelated words, it seems. One that I didn't know until I looked this up. Veres, or veres, V-E-R-R-E-S, is an uncastrated male pig. So an adult male pig. Not a word I know. I know that only as a name of a bad governor of Sicily that Cicero made his name with orations against, veres. So I did not know that. But the one that I did know for a male pig is aper.
Right.
But that's a wild boar.
Wild
so that's
boar,
the word
right.
for a wild boar, not for
a domesticated
animal, right. animal which was hunted and does turn up quite often in various contexts. And then the last, oh, sorry, did you want to say anything about
pigs? Pig, yeah. Pig is a mystery word.
This is a theme, isn't it, for these? I mean, in a way, it's not totally surprising for these really old words, right? I mean, they're as old as the domesticated animal, presumably, so.
Yeah. Well, I mean, swine is the older word, you know, comes from Anglo-Saxon. Mm-hmm. Pig doesn't show up until the 13th century, and yet it's believed to have come from an old English word that just never got written down, which is surprising. That's really late, 13th century.
Yeah, that is odd.
It might be related to the word pike because of the pointed snout.
Okay.
So a pointy snout animal.
Okay.
That's the best guess.
Huh, interesting. And so not related to pork or porcus?
No, presumably not. What do we call the meat? We call it pork. Obviously, we get that through French. Or ham, I suppose, is the other meat-related word. But that refers to the body part. And originally, it could refer to the ham of any animal. Ham is like a hamstring, the part of the leg or whatever.
And it doesn't necessarily need to be what we salted and cured.
Salted and cured,
That's a later thing. Okay, then the last one I wanted to mention is chickens. I don't have very much to say about chickens.
And this is the one that breaks the pattern, which is why I didn't mention it in the video, because...
Poultry,
I guess.
But poultry we use for... I mean, we do use it as a culinary term too, but we certainly also use it as an agricultural term.
And so this breaks... Because chicken, referring to the meat... And to the animal is an old English word.
Right. Yes, because the Latin words are gallus for the cock or the rooster, gallina for the hen, and pullus for the young animal, which actually is a pullus can just mean any young animal, but can also mean specifically a young chicken, and a pullet, which is where we get the English word, not that most people probably know it because it's a very technical term, pullet meaning young, not chick, but...
Right.
Not fully adult
animal,
which is basically most of the chickens that we actually eat, to my understanding. It's also a pet name for a young boy, in particular a young boy used for sexual services. A lot of these young animal names are also, or in fact, animal names are pet names of various sorts, which is not particularly surprising. That is a thing to call people by animal names as a pet name. Gallus, of course, sounds like the word for Gauls.
Gauls.
Gallus. Which is why the symbol for France as a nation is a rooster.
Ah, there you go.
Because of the pun on Gallus. And it comes from a sort of late antique, early medieval recognition of that pun.
Interesting.
Pullus seems to be the word that probably gives us poultry.
Yeah.
And poule. So it's interesting that as the word for the young, for the what is essentially the chick, gives us those words.
Well, and that is interesting because that Latin root is related, and the word poultry as well, is related to foal.
Right. So as I said, pullus means
animal.
Young animal.
Yeah.
And in fact, pullus can mean
pony.
Young horse. I didn't.
It's related to pony as well. That, so yeah. Young horse.
Okay.
And it's also.
Not that a pony is a young horse, for the record.
Oh, well.
Anyway, now.
It's also related to the word few and poor. Which gives me a sort of idea or a speculation about why maybe chicken breaks the pattern. That maybe chicken is an animal that your average peasant might have enough contact with.
Yeah, that's probably true, that it was not as reserved.
You're
for
not going to eat beef. You're not going to eat, you know, expensive animals like that. But you might be able to afford some chickens.
Well, you may very well keep chickens.
Chickens.
And then when they stop laying, you eat them.
You eat them. Yeah.
Yeah, so that does make some sense. Yeah.
That's my best guess anyways for that.
Yeah, no, chickens are certainly, I mean, I was going down these in essentially descending order of economic importance to the Romans. Though swine is kind of an outlier there because pigs were really important and they ate a lot of pigs. They weren't as high status for the Romans. Right.
But they were an important food source.
They were an important food. And that brings me to the last thing I wanted to just bring up, which is about people who looked after these animals. And I wanted to bring this up because of a connection to Latin poetry. So I said that, you know, these terms turn up in Latin texts often. And one of the places they turn up, not the only, but one of the very important places they turn up is in Virgil. Because Virgil's...
In the Eclogues?
Yes. Virgil's very famous, of course, for writing the Aeneid, the epic about the founding of Rome. But his first two works were the Eclogues and the Georgics. The Eclogues are a series of poems about shepherds or herdsmen. I'll get back to that in a moment. Singing in the hills around Rome and Sicily and places. And the Georgics is a whole set of poems. It's four poems, four books on farming. Georgics, the farmer poems. So of course they have lots and lots and lots of terms for animals, and they're basically wisdom poetry, though with lots of other things to say, but about how to farm cattle and how to farm wine, grapes for wine, and how to raise bees. They're much more complex than that, but I haven't actually studied the Georgics well enough to give you a lot on them. But I have thought about the Eclogues. And one of the things about that's interesting about the Eclogues is they are riffing very, very strongly on Theocritus's Idylls, this is a Hellenistic Greek poet who wrote a series of poems, again, set with herdsmen around Sicily in the Greek world. And so these are sort of translated and then adapted and then modified by Virgil. In Virgil's in particular, there is a hierarchy of herdsmen. So they're often talked about as being pastoral poetry.
Right.
And they are what initiate the genre of pastoral poetry in English. And a whole bunch of pastoral poetry in the Augustan period in English looks back to the Eclogues, and they're really important. But pastor is a shepherd.
Right.
Okay. So a shepherd is someone who looks after
sheep,
a sheep herd.
Right.
We tend to think of that word as almost sort of a catch-all word, but of course it's a sheep herd.
Yeah.
And the word for that is pastor. There was also a word ovilio. Higher than that in status, though, is a cowherd.
Ah.
Or, as my Latin dictionaries tend to translate it in a way that is entirely incomprehensible to anyone in the modern world, a neat herd.
Neat herd?
Yes. Ah. Neat herd.
Not a cowboy.
No, not a cowboy. A neat herd. So apparently neat is an older English word for cattle.
Neat spelled how?
N-E-A-T. Go ahead and look that one up.
Oh, it's an old English word.
I assume it must be, but it's just not.
Ox, bullock, cow.
Yeah.
Old English, nat. Interestingly, it comes from a root that means thing of value, possession.
Right.
So
like pecus.
From a root that ultimately an Indo-European root that means to make use of, to enjoy.
Right. I can understand that. The words for a cowherd do not turn up in the Eclogues, I think for metrical reasons as much as anything, and probably because they were prosaic. So armentarius, which goes back to armentum as a word for cattle, bubulcus, meaning ox driver or plowman, and bubsequa, which I really like.
Bubsequa.
Meaning a follower of bubos.
Bubos. Okay.
Right? Yeah. A follower of, that's a post-classical term. The word doesn't turn up. However, the first very important figure who turns up in the Eclogues, Titurus, who for all sorts of reasons I will not get into is hugely important, his name and all sorts of things for the sort of genre of the Eclogues, so therefore for pastoral poetry in general, he's a cowherd. He's not a shepherd. He's a cowherd.
Okay.
And he meets, in this first Eclogue, in Eclogue 1, meliboeus, meaning two Greek words. Melis is song, boeus is cow. And yet Meliboeus is a goat herd. Now, there's no special word for a goat herd in Latin that I could find anyway that's recorded. So pastor can mean goat herd as well.
Right.
But there's the status level, which is, so the highest is a cow herd because cows are the most economically valuable, followed then by shepherds, followed by goat herds. And then at the bottom, swine herds.
Right.
And the words for swine herds are fairly predictable. Suarius. Sibotes, which is a Greek word for them, which I don't know. Subotes, it's the same.
Right.
And subulcus. So, and then way down, they aren't really a job title, is gallinarius, one who looks after poultry.
Right.
They don't turn up in the eclogues at all. But so there's this, in the eclogues, there's a status
of
who is the more important. They're all probably slaves.
But still,
of course, the status matters. Because human beings do status. So I thought maybe I would just give you a first couple of, like, a line or two of Eclogue 1, because it is very famous in a very small subgroup of people. So Eclogue 1 opens with Meliboeus addressing Tityrus, as I said, that so he's sort of almost the titular figure of pastoral poetry. Titure tu patulae recubans sub tegmini ne fagi silvestrum tenui musam meditaris avena. So those first two lines, I'm sorry, that was not terribly well read, but Tityrus, lying there under the spreading beech tree cover, you study the woodland muse on slender shepherd's pipe. The sort of opening of pastoral poetry. And it's known as pastoral poetry in English, but it's also known as, so these are called the eclogues, but they're also sometimes called the bucolics.
Right.
Bucolics, of course. Bucolic. Is cowherd.
Right.
The Greek word for cowherd. And it's interesting, I think, because there's this distinction between pastoral and bucolic in English, those two adjectives. So we talk about pastoral poetry or the pastoral symphony, Beethoven's pastoral symphony.
Yeah.
Meaning, and when I say pastoral, I think people think of rolling hills and green meadows and
untouched countryside.
Well, the kind of countryside on which you graze sheep.
Right, yes.
Not untouched.
Not untouched. No, yeah. I suppose not.
But still, like, yeah, the rolling meadows, right?
Meadows,
you think of
meadows
and lying, and lying in the grass and flowers. Bucolic, as an English adjective, means of the countryside as well, but tends to mean rustic, I think. Or, I mean, I think it has the connotations of rustic and more to do with the farmyard.
Farmyard, yeah.
Yeah. So it's just interesting that those...
Enclosed as opposed to...
Well, yeah, or working as opposed to relaxing, maybe. Pastoral is very... And that is, you know, the eclogues are about this kind of idealized leisure time, which, oddly, these enslaved shepherds have, as opposed to the city dwellers who own them.
Right.
But who are somehow caught up in the world of politics and money-making. Yeah, there's this whole kind of contrast going on between this pastoral world and the urban world that doesn't really make any sense when you break it down, but it's clearly sort of an idealized thing going on. And I think that's carried through into what pastoral means in modern English. And yet we have there again the sort of shepherd versus the cowherd. But in the eclogues, you have all of those. You have Tityrus, who's the cowherd. You have Coridon, he's in Eclogue 2, and he's real important, and he reappears as well, who's a shepherd, who's a properly as sheep. And then you have Meliboeus as a goatherd. And so all the way through, you have goatherds, shepherds, and cowherds. And they have this kind of shifting economic status and importance. In their love affairs, they trump one another depending on what kind of animals they have to offer to their beloved and things like that. So, and then there's a whole bunch of poetic resonances to their animals and the importance of them. So I just thought I'd mention that. I mean, these terms sound to our ears now, I think, very much like they're sort of a bygone age, and they're very technical. They're to do with farming, but they come up in these very poetic contexts. They have an importance if you're reading older Latin poetry, for instance, that is removed from necessarily their basic agricultural importance, but also shows you how much closer the world of these Latin poets was to that agricultural and economic world of, you know, the importance of herd animals and what type of age they were and those sorts of things in a way that we aren't. Okay, that's all I think I had to say.
I have one last chicken word to add, which connects back to both a previous video and a previous podcast, and that is the word capon.
Ah, capon, indeed.
Right, which we've talked about in the Valentine's
cuckold episode.
The capon is the castrated male chicken.
There we go. Male chicken.
Male chicken. Yeah. There
just
isn't
like
a word.
Male, male cow. Yeah.
But it's not a rooster though, specifically because it's a capon. Because
it's
castrated.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And well, capon literally means cut from Latin.
Right. It's been cut.
It's been cut.
Makes sense to me. All right. Well, I think that's probably enough animal terms for now. If you've listened all the way through, thanks for bearing with us. I thought it was interesting about all these Latin words, but it's a lot of vocabulary. But now if you go and often read some Virgil, you'll know the important details of the agricultural world he's talking about. So we'll be back soon, I hope. It may be a little while before we manage another episode. Some life things have been getting in the way recently. But we'll try to come back before the end of the summer with another one. And until then, I hope you have a good end of the summer if you've been listening to this in real time. Good night.
Bye-bye.
For more information on this podcast, check out the website www.alliterative.net, where you can find links to the videos, blog posts, sources, and credits. We've also got all the ways you can follow us: Twitter, Facebook, Tumblr, G+, a mailing list, and Instagram. And please check out our Patreon, where you can pledge to support this show and our video project.
You can go directly to the videos at youtube.com/alliterative. Our email is on the website, but the easiest way to get in touch with us is on Twitter. I'm at Avensarah, AVENSARAH.
And I'm at Alliterative.
To keep up with the podcast, subscribe on iTunes or to the feed on the website. And please review it on iTunes if you can and if you've enjoyed it. It helps us a lot. We'll be back soon with more musings about the connections around us. Thanks for listening.
Bye.